Today is October the 10th, 2018.
Do you know who has your personal data besides Facebook? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the programs available on wbai.org/archive, prn.fm, and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program except when WBAI is in a membership drive. WBAI is in a membership drive tonight, and the programs are different. Tonight we will start off with a blockbuster news from Bloomberg Businessweek that China used a tiny chip to infiltrate U.S. companies for the past 3 years. However, Apple and Amazon said it never happened. What are we to believe is the truth? In a major news article by Bloomberg Businessweek, they reported how China used a tiny chip to infiltrate U.S. companies. The attack by Chinese spies reached almost 30 U.S. companies, including Amazon and Apple, by compromising America's technology supply chain. Back in 2015, Amazon was evaluating the potential acquisition of a startup company as part of a major expansion of its streaming video service, known today as Amazon Prime Video. This startup company, Elemental, made software for compressing massive video files and formatting them for different devices. The proposed acquisition of Elemental fit with Amazon's government business, such as a highly secure cloud that Amazon Web Services, which we know as AWS, was building for the CIA. Yeah, that's right. They're building something for the CIA, or they built it for the CIA. To help with due diligence, however, because it's with the CIA, Amazon hired a third-party company to scrutinize Elemental security. The initial finding uncovered troubling issues, prompting Amazon to take a closer look at Elemental's main product, the expensive servers that customers install in their networks to handle the video compression. These servers were assembled for Elemental by Supermicro Computer Inc., a San Jose-based company commonly known as Supermicro, that's also one of the world's biggest suppliers of server motherboards. In late spring of 2015, Elemental staff boxed up several servers and sent them to Ontario, Canada, for the third-party security company to test. And nested on the server's motherboard, the testers found a tiny microchip, not much bigger than a grain of rice. That wasn't part of the board's original design. Amazon reported the discovery to U.S. authorities, sending a shudder through the intelligence community. Elemental servers could be found in the Department of Defense data centers, the CIA's drone operation, and the onboard networks of Navy warships, and Elemental's was just one of hundreds of Supermicro customers. In a top-secret probe for more than 3 years, investigators determined that the chips allowed the attackers to create a stealth doorway into any network that included the altered machines. Multiple people familiar with the matter said investigators found that the chips had been inserted at factories run by manufacturing subcontractors in China. This attack was quite devastating compared to software-based incidents the world has grown accustomed to seeing in hacks. Hardware hacks are more difficult to pull off. There are two ways for spies to alter the guts of computer equipment. One is known as interdiction, consisting of manipulating devices as they're in transit from one manufacturer to the customer. This approach is favored by U.S. spy agencies, according to Edward Snowden. The other method involves seeding changes from the very beginning. One country in particular has an advantage executing this kind of attack. That's China, which by some estimates makes 75% of the world's mobile phones and 90% of its PCs. To accomplish a seeding attack would mean developing a deep understanding of a product's design and manipulating components at the factory. That's just what U.S. investigators found. The chip had been inserted during the manufacturing process. Two officials said by operatives from a unit of the People's Liberation Army that this was going on. In Super Micro, China spies appear to have found a perfect conduit for what U.S. officials now describe as the most significant supply chain attack known to have been carried out against American companies. One official says investigators found that it eventually affected almost 30 companies, including a major bank, government contractors, and the world's most valuable company, Apple Inc. Apple was an important Super Micro customer and had planned to order more than 30,000 of its servers in 2 years for a new global network of data centers. Three senior insiders at Apple said that in the summer of 2015, it too found malicious chips on Supermicro motherboards, and Apple severed ties with Supermicro the following year for what is described as unrelated reasons. A spokesman for Supermicro said, "The supply chain safety in cyberspace is an issue of common concern, and China also is a victim." Oh yeah, sure. The company's denials are countered by six current and former senior national security officials in conversations that began during the Obama administration and continue under the Trump administration, detailed the discovery of the chips and the government's investigation. One government official says China's goal was long-term access to high-value corporate secrets and sensitive government networks. No consumer data is known to have been stolen, that we know of. The ramifications of the attack continue to play out. The Trump administration has made computer and networking hardware, including motherboards, a focus of its latest round of trade sanctions against China. Some of the companies will begin shifting their supply chains to other countries as a result. Officials have been warning for years about the security of the supply chain. Two of Elemental's biggest early clients were the Mormon Church, which used the technology to beam sermons to congregations around the world, and the adult film industry. Elemental also started working with American spy agencies. In 2009, the company announced a development partnership with the CIA that paved the way for Elemental servers to be used in national security missions across U.S. governments. Supermicro's motherboards would be engineered mostly in San Jose, close to the company's biggest clients, even if the products were to be manufactured overseas. Today, Supermicro sells more server motherboards than almost anyone else. It also dominates the $1 billion market for boards used in special-purpose computers, from MRI machines to weapon systems. Its motherboards can be found in made-to-order server setups at banks, hedge funds, cloud computing providers, and web hosting services, among other places. Supermicro has assembly facilities in California, the Netherlands, and Taiwan, but its motherboards, its core product, are nearly all manufactured by contractors in China. A U.S. official says the government's probe is still examining whether spies were planted inside Supermicro or other American companies to aid the attack. With more than 900 customers in 100 countries by the year 2015, Supermicro offered inroads to a bountiful collection of sensitive targets. Think of Supermicro as a Microsoft of the hardware world. Attacking Supermicro motherboards is like attacking Windows. It's like attacking the whole world. The security of the global technology supply chain had been compromised, even if consumers and most companies didn't know it yet. Stay tuned. Last week, Bloomberg News reported that tiny Chinese chips had compromised the security of Apple and Amazon data centers. Apple sent a letter to Congress this past Monday claiming that the Bloomberg story was just simply wrong. The Bloomberg story, published last week, claimed that the Chinese government had secretly added spy chips to the motherboards of servers sold by Supermicro. According to Bloomberg, these servers wound up in the data centers of almost 30 companies, including Apple and Amazon. But the three companies featured in the story, Apple, Amazon, and Supermicro, have all issued strongly worded denials. The stakes are very high for Apple. Millions of Americans rely on the company to protect the privacy of their data on iCloud and other online services. If there were really Chinese chips infiltrating Apple data centers, it would really call into question the security of those services. But Apple insists that the whole news item from Bloomberg was simply bogus. In the newsletter to top lawmakers on the House and Senate Commerce Committees, Apple says the company worked tirelessly to investigate the Bloomberg's claims in the months before Bloomberg's published its story. And their internal investigations directly contradict every consequential assertion made in the article. Apple also said they never found any malicious chips, hardware manipulations, or vulnerabilities purposely planted in any server. Notice the careful word they use is purposely. Apple's denials are clear and unequivocal. Back in 2013, whistleblower Edward Snowden released documents showing that the NSA had a secret program called PRISM that allowed the agency to access private data on cloud services. A number of companies, including Apple, issued carefully worded denials. Several of them focus on claims in the initial Washington Post story that the NSA had direct access to user data. But while some of these details may have been wrong, the basic thrust of the story was correct. Major tech companies really were participating in a secret NSA spying program called PRISM. This has led some people to wonder if something similar might be going on with Apple and Supermicro. But Apple's broadly worded denials and its decision to continue hammering away at the story seem to rule that out. Their investigations directly contradict every consequential assertion made in the article, as cited by Apple. They said that they never alerted the FBI to any security concerns like those described in the article, nor has the FBI ever contacted us about such an investigation. In a follow-up email, Apple confirmed that this denial applies to other government agencies as well. Amazon's denial was also broad and unequivocal. At no time, past or present, have we ever found any issues relating to modified hardware or malicious chips in Supermicro motherboards. Supermicro also said the same thing. Over the weekend, Apple received backup from the Department of Homeland Security, which issued a statement that they have no reason to doubt the statements from the companies named in the story. That was somewhat of a narrow denial than the ones Apple and Amazon gave out last week, but it seemed to bolster the statements made by those companies. And it's notable that it hasn't happened in the 4 days since Bloomberg published the article that in the wake of a big story like this, well-sourced reporters at major news organizations scrambled to confirm it. As far as we know, that hasn't happened yet. So far, no one has produced a Supermicro circuit board with a spy chip embedded in it. Bloomberg claims that nearly 30 companies were affected by the attack, so you might expect someone from at least one of those companies to report finding a modified board. Again, as far as we know, this hasn't happened, but as we know in the past, many companies will deny certain things because it would hurt the public relation image of the company, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen. Bloomberg's article included an animated image showing a tiny microchip on a crowded circuit board, but it remains unclear whether this was a photograph of an actual board or a Photoshop. Well, someone is wrong about the China hack story. A blockbuster Bloomberg Businessweek news article was published claiming that China's People's Liberation Army had managed to crack the manufacturing supply chain and hack chips in servers manufactured by a company called Supermicro, chips used by Amazon, Apple, and around 30 other American companies. It means that the foundation of the last 25 years of electronics manufacturing, the use of cheap and serpentine supply chains, many based out of China to manufacture electronics design and assembled across the globe, has been compromised. It's a world-shaking story if it's true. It is not uncommon for big companies to carefully deny damaging stories whose main thrust is true, but it is unthinkable for a large and publicly traded company to categorically and comprehensively deny the claims of an article like this unless they're really not true. On the other hand, Bloomberg Businessweek is known as both one of the best and one of the most cautious publications in the world of business and national security reporting. It is equally unthinkable that it would have published a story this shocking without having reported it deeply. The reporters write that they have 17 sources and have thoroughly checked it out legally. net-net, which means after all is said and done, what do we have? Perhaps the denials are part of some government master plan, with Apple and Amazon working in concert with the government or at the orders of authorities, but just doesn't want to hold up. Bloomberg wouldn't blow up its reputation on a bogus story. We can't understand why Apple and Amazon seem to be overly broad in their denials unless they are very, very sure of what the facts are. If we give all sides the benefit of the doubt, we could imagine a world where all of them believe that they are telling the truth. What we cannot see is a world where all parties are actually right. What do we need to know? To paraphrase a Sergeant Joe Friday quote from the TV series Dragnet, all we want are the facts, ma'am, and all we know are the facts, ma'am. So what do we have? This is what we recommend. If your information is not to be shared with anyone else, do not back it up on the cloud. If the cloud is your sole source of backup, you better find a local backup under your control. And if you have any doubts at all about your personal data being safe in the cloud, don't store it in the cloud. Apple is having a problem with some of its releases, both hardware and software. Well, let's talk about the Apple Watch. Apple Watch has a daylight saving bug that leaves Series 4 devices in a loop. Australians with a certain watch face features are in for a headache. Apple is still grappling with the daylight savings time issues after all these years. Some Australian Apple Watch Series 4 owners have reported that their devices are stuck in reboot loops after the country switched to daylight standard time this weekend. Apparently, the activity complication on the Series 4 Infograph modular face doesn't know how to handle a day that's an hour short. So long as that complication is active, the smartwatch crashes and restarts until it runs out of power. Some users have had success changing the face through the watch app on the iPhone, but the only surefire solution may be to wait until the shortened day is over with. Apple, by the way, has no comment. While this sounds like a temporary problem, it could be a recurring one that there is no fix. Daylight savings time ends in North America on November the 4th, for instance. While it's not certain if the bug applies when you gain an extra hour in the day, Series 4 users might not want to find out firsthand. Online sales tax laws went into effect in 10 states October 1st. The statutes, which vary by state, allow states to require the collection of state sales tax from e-commerce sellers whether or not those businesses physically operate within the state's borders. The states with new online sales tax going into effect includes Alabama, Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Michigan, North Dakota, Washington State, and Wisconsin. Similar laws are expected to go into effect in Connecticut and Iowa. For now, the list of states that have passed statutes or regulations to require online sales tax collection has reached 32. The new laws follow the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in June to overturn a decades-old precedent that limited state sales tax collection to retailers who maintain a physical presence within a state. In the case of South Dakota versus Wayfair, the court was asked to review a 1992 ruling that outlined how states and other localities could tax goods sold outside of their borders, initially intended to regulate the catalog-based retail industry. The ruling has been challenged again and again over the years as states sought to get their fair share with e-commerce sales, and at brick-and-mortar stores sought to fight back against the growing threat of online-only shops. The ruling cited how drastically internet access has changed since the 1992 ruling. Just 2% of the U.S. adult population had access to the web back then, compared to 90% today. E-commerce sales totaled roughly $453 billion last year. That's about almost $500 billion, or about 10% of the total U.S. retail sales, which is up from 0.2% of total sales back in 1998. With nearly every state cash-strapped and looking for fresh streams of revenue, it wouldn't be a major stretch to guess that all 50 states will have some sort of e-commerce sales tax law on their books within the next year. Wearable and Health Technologies by Dr. Alfred Poor. He's going to be covering hands-on testing of remote patient monitoring, a wearable company survives corporate acquisition, and organs on a chip could speed drug development.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
I may have seen the future of remote patient monitoring, or actually, to be more accurate, I've worn the future, and actually, it's something that's available now. One of the big drawbacks about healthcare, the way it's practiced now, is typically patients have to go someplace to see a healthcare professional. Go to the hospital, go to the doctor's office, whatever. And while there, somebody takes your vital signs and knows what your body temperature is and your heart rate and your respiration rate and so forth. But they don't know what happens when you go back home again. And here's the problem, because you can spike a fever, you can have some change in your heart rate, some other kinds of problems. And you don't find out again until you get back to the hospital or get back to the office, and sometimes under emergency circumstances. So one of the big deals about health tech these days is the ability to monitor a patient once they've been discharged or once they've gone back home. And recently I got to try out a system from a company called Vital Connect, and we've written about it before. They make a device called the Vital Patch. It's a battery-operated, wireless, smart patch that attaches to your skin and monitors your vital signs. And it can transmit this wirelessly to a dashboard at a nursing station, so the health staff at a hospital can monitor a number of patients all at once, and it can throw up alerts when somebody's readings fall outside the range of what's been said as acceptable. I can also detect a fall, can detect when a patient goes from standing to lying down or vice versa. And so it really makes it easier for the hospital staff to keep track of patients. But what do you do when the patient goes home? One of the things you need is a way to communicate between the patch and the system. What Vital Connect has done is they've created what they call the Vista tablet. And this is an off-the-shelf Android tablet that runs a custom software system, and it communicates wirelessly, Wi-Fi if you have it, and it uses cell data transmissions if you don't, and it transmits the data up to the system where the data can be stored and shared, securely accessed only by those healthcare professionals who are authorized to see it and so forth. It was very cool. I got a chance to try one out for a while. The patch will run for up to 5 days on the battery, and then you have to swap it out for another patch. It was easy to set up, and since you don't have to install something on a smartphone or even have Wi-Fi available in the house, it makes it very simple to connect. I was able to apply the patch myself, and it worked just fine, reporting my heart rate, my activity levels, and I could even monitor those on the tablet myself to see what was there. You don't have to keep the tablet right with you all the time. If you go away from it, the patch will store the data and then upload it to the tablet when it gets back within range. But in order to get the alerts issued on a timely basis, you want to keep the tablet nearby as much as you can. It's okay to wear it in the shower as long as you just don't let the water run on it directly, but you will want to avoid very wet environments or where you get very sweaty, such as swimming. You can't go swimming. You shouldn't go in a steam bath or a sauna or something like that where you'd sweat a lot. And if you're very active and sweat a lot, that could cause a problem. In fact, I had a little bit of trouble with that, with the patch coming loose when I was sweating heavily at one point. According to somebody at the company that I spoke with, it's possible to put a protective covering over the whole patch to help it adhere better if you're going to be sweating a lot, which could cause the adhesive not to hold as well. By and large, it was very simple, very easy. They even gave me access to the dashboard that a doctor would see. So I was able to see what my historical data was looking like, and I could see what my ECG, my heart traces, would look like. And it was very, very simple. So I think that as this technology becomes less expensive and more readily available, I fully expect to see this used for other applications than just post-discharge for hospital patients. I could see even family doctors using this kind of technology to help keep track of patients in their home when they're ill, so that they can monitor and make sure that they know if the situation is getting worse and is in need of more urgent attention. This next story is more of an industry story than it is about the specific product. The specific product that I'm talking about is another smartwatch. And no, it's not the Apple Watch 4. That's been getting plenty of attention, but this is a different one. This is actually a smartwatch from Withings, and it's called the Steel HR Sport. It does kind of the fitness things that you would expect a smartwatch to do. It does heart rate, tracks your exercise, whether you're walking, swimming, running, biking. It tracks elevation. It's got GPS built in, so it can measure the distance that you go. It has notifications from more than 100 different apps from your smartphone, so it conveys a lot of information. But the real interesting thing about this watch isn't so much its feature set, though it's interesting, but it's the company that it came from. It's, again, from Withings, and Withings is notable because a while back, it was purchased by Nokia, famous for making cell phones. Well, Nokia thought about it for a while and had it for a while and then decided they didn't want the company anymore. And in fact, it was bought back by the original founder of Withings. So it's now an independent company again, has launched this latest version of its smartwatch. The interesting thing on a larger scale here is we're used to hearing stories about small companies getting bought up by the larger companies and their technology integrated, and occasionally their technology killed off. Turns out to be a dead branch on the tree of growth for that company. So it's rare to hear about a small company being acquired and assimilated by a larger company and then being thrown back to the ocean and reviving itself as an original small company. Withings has done a lot of innovative stuff in the whole wearable and general health tech field, and it will be very interesting to keep an eye on them and see if they can be successful as an independent company, or perhaps even they may be acquired again by somebody else. It'll be interesting to watch and see what happens next. Scientific research is amazing what it can accomplish. Basically, the whole concept is that you come up with a theory, you test it, you make sure your test is reliable, and you see what the results are. Now, in medicine, this means that sometimes you want to test products, a medication or something, and see how the human body reacts to it. However, human experimentation is generally frowned upon these days. It was okay back in the early days when we were fighting yellow fever and things like that, but pretty much these days, human experiments are only undertaken when it's been determined that they're likely to be safe, or that the circumstances are so dire that there's no other alternative. Well, one of the interesting things that's happening as an alternative to human testing or even lab animal testing is that technology is now making it available to create a device on a chip that mimics the behavior of human tissues and human organs. All right, we've had labs on a chip that can identify materials in very small amounts. We've had those for quite a while, but now what's interesting that's coming online are a number of different devices that act like human organs and human tissues and can be used for testing. We've seen this with 3D printed hearts on a chip. We've had a chip to mimic liver and kidney function. Well, a new group has developed a device that creates an environment similar to human cells of different specific tissues and organs, and they can create an organ on the chip that will then be used for testing for medications and other kinds of treatments, even includes an artificial blood system. So this can, first of all, speed testing because it can eliminate bad solutions much more quickly without harming people, and it's also safer. So drug development could see a lot of benefit, lower cost, shorter time to market using this organ on a chip technology. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. From the Tech Corner, Joe and I will be talking about Google Plus going off into the sunset. What is Google Plus? Google Plus is a social network from Google.
Google Plus was open to a small number of users back in June 2011. Google then gave some of those initial users invitations to invite a small number of their contacts. The service has since been opened up to everyone, and it was given an overhaul in April in 2012. You can share messages or links with everyone or with only those within designated circles. This gives you more flexibility than Twitter and is a similar concept to groups on Facebook. Your circles are private, that is, no one can see how you've named your circles or which circles they or anyone else can be put into. You can upload and organize photos using Google Photos, previously called Picasa. Well, why am I talking about this? Over the next 10 months, Google is shutting down Google Plus for consumers following security lapse. The decision follows the revelation of a previously undisclosed security flaw that exposed users' profile data that was remedied in March of this year. Google says Google Plus currently has low usage and engagement, and that 90% of Google Plus user sessions last less than 5 seconds. Hey, that's almost non-usage. Still, the company plans to keep the service alive for enterprise customers who use it to facilitate conversation among coworkers. Google is focusing on a secure corporate social network, which is odd considering this announcement comes alongside news that the company left the profile details unprotected. Google also announced new privacy adjustments for other Google services. API changes will limit developers' access to data on Android devices and Gmail. Developers will no longer receive call logs and SMS permissions on Android devices, and contact interaction data won't be available through the Android Contacts API. Last year, Google announced that it would stop its long-standing practice of scanning the contents of individual Gmail users for advertising purposes. Of course, the company still has plenty of data it can target advertisements against, like search history, YouTube views, and other Chrome actions. Google Plus is shutting down, and it got Joe thinking.
A friend of mine came over the other day, and while we were talking, he said, "Oh, incidentally, would you mind giving me all your personal information? You know, things like date of birth and where you come from and where you went to school and, you know, things like that." I said, why on earth would I do that? That's all you need to know in order to steal my identity. Well, he said to me, you've done that. You've done exactly that with people you don't know. Why would you want to not give it to me? I could use that information, particularly your bank account number and some of your charge card passwords. And I looked at him as if he was insane. In my mind, he was. I said, would you mind telling me exactly why you think I have given that information to perfect strangers? He said, no problem at all. As a matter of fact, I read about it in the paper. Did you know, he said to me, that all the information you've given over the years to Facebook was stolen? Millions and millions and millions of records were stolen. And now did you know that it was so bad what Gmail or Google has done that they've just walked away from it? They've closed their Google Plus social network. Social network. What the hell is a social network? Social network. Oh, you mean one of those, back in the old days, we used to call them public bulletin boards, computer bulletin boards, where you just post things for everybody to read. No, he said. These promised that you would not post them publicly, but this would all be very well-protected private information. I asked him where he got that idea from, that it would be well-protected. He said, they told me before I signed up that it would all be well-protected. I said, they told you that? Wow. Hey, how about I got a great idea. I got a bridge I'm willing to sell you for a real good price. It's the Brooklyn-Manhattan Bridge. It's right next to the Brooklyn Bridge, only it's a separate one, and I can let you have it for a very reasonable price. Because if you believe that these companies were going to really protect your information, you are about the most gullible person I have ever met. There's a couple of ways to approach it. One of my relatives asked me, and I told him there was indeed a way to be safe, completely safe, on Facebook. And it's pretty simple. Don't put in anything that's the truth other than your name. And if possible, you shouldn't put your whole name in. Instead of Joe King, which everybody knows, how about J. King? And instead of putting a period after the J, make it all one word, J. King. And then don't put down your birth date, of course. Put down a date that you can remember, the date you got married or the date you graduated from college, some date that's nonspecific to your life. And don't put down any information about credit cards, bank accounts, anything at all that you wouldn't really want to have posted on a 30-sheet bulletin board outside the Lincoln Tunnel coming into New York. Well, you ask, what good would that be? I'm not sure, but I don't think it would affect many of the things. Yes, it would affect the fact that you could not join your school alumni group. You could not join a church or its synagogue group. You couldn't join anything that had any personal identification information. And then he asked me again, well, what would be wrong with that? Suppose everybody knew what synagogue or church I went to and what college I went to. It's not really a problem. But remember, you've heard the phrase big data. You saw it in the Times. Well, let me tell you about big data. We'll take all the information that we can get off Facebook, and then we'll take all the information that we can get off Google+, and all the information that we can get on LinkedIn and all the other social networks, the images, words, pictures, anything at all, and we put it all into one huge database. Doesn't mean anything to anybody, but then people like Hank, they can come along and write a clever algorithm and run it against the big data, and pretty soon they can have a pretty good picture of who you are and what you do and why you do it. And it's all information that you gave. You didn't think it was a big problem when you filled out that questionnaire somebody sent you about how long is your commute into the city. But now that's part of the big data, and they know you're not living in the city, and they know exactly where you're living and how long you're going to be away from your house. Big data. I got another way of looking at it. Personal data. Hank says at the beginning of every radio show, he says, do you know who has your personal data today? Hank, the answer to that is universal. No, we don't. But I do know that every piece of social networking that is out there is dangerous. And I'm trying very hard to get rid of everything that has my name associated with it. I would suggest you do too.
Those attacks on U.S. embassy workers that make them feel sick are based on some very old science. Some of it more than a century old. Some of it secretly tested by France in the 1950s. It is at the heart of every super heterodyne radio. There's a little addition and subtraction to it. Hey, Marty, tell them the rest of the math.
What I want to talk about this time could potentially apply to a cybernetic house, but I'll leave that discussion for the end. Before I get to that, I want to start with an old technology called radio, touch on one of the gizmos from the original Star Trek series, tell you what that has to do with the mysterious attacks on U.S. embassy workers, and then get into how it's relevant to self-driving cars and maybe my project house. It all starts a century ago. Let me see how much basic radio I can help you understand in just a few seconds. I think you know that radio communications happens using electromagnetic waves, and that there is a basic frequency coming from the transmitter that you have to match by tuning in a receiver. With luck, at some point in your life, you've seen a radio with an actual dial, so you have a sense of what tuning in is all about. In early radio, that carrier just got turned on and off. It was called a continuous wave because when it was on, it was just on. Turning it on and off in patterns that both the person sending and the person receiving could recognize already had a precedent, the Morse telegraph. And the Morse code also became the standard for its wireless counterpart, radio telegraphy. Then, radio engineers discovered that they could change the strength of the radio signal in a way that would carry the sound of a voice or of music. Changing the radio wave this way is called modulation, and when that happens by changing its strength, the amplitude of the signal, that's called amplitude modulation, or AM for short. Just in case you've ever come across an AM radio, that's why it's called that. FM, if you're curious, stands for frequency modulation. All you need to know right now is that these wiggly waves have to be tuned in to be heard, and it was very difficult in those early years for receivers to directly amplify just the voice or music, the modulation part of a received signal. And there were lots and lots of experiments trying out different approaches to that. Finally, 100 years ago, in 1918, they came up with a great little trick that's still around. They didn't try to work directly with the received signal on its own frequency. Instead, they moved it to a lower frequency that was easier to work with, especially because no matter what frequency was being transmitted, the radio could convert it to this one lower frequency called the intermediate frequency. That one frequency was easier to amplify and to separate out the audio using a thing called a detector. There won't be a quiz. Don't worry about remembering all this. And then, taking that audio, they could amplify that. That approach to reception is still with us. It has kind of a long name, but I'll quickly describe it first. And it's this description that's the connection among all the topics I rattled off up top. The trick is that when you mix signals on two frequencies, in addition to having the original two frequencies, you also get their sum and their difference. It's called the heterodyne effect. The word superheterodyne was used to describe that early avalanche of radio receivers that took advantage of the heterodyne effect. What's that have to do with Star Trek? Well, back in the 1970s, I was intrigued by the idea of the phaser because it had a non-lethal stun mode. Even then, when something intrigued me, I would dig in and do a lot of homework. I discovered a lot of work the French had done with acoustic weapons research in the 1950s and 60s. I learned of ultrasonic lenses roughly the size of a ping pong ball that could shape ultrasonics into a tight beam. One of the mail order houses was selling ultrasonic transducers. I was pretty sure I could build something that worked like a phaser, with the option to kill or to merely induce unconsciousness. And that would be based on the selection and intensity of primarily infrasonic below the audio range and ultrasonic above the audio range documented frequencies. I never built it, but hang on to that idea as we fast forward to the attacks on U.S. embassy personnel. What happened there sounded very familiar to me, so I'm pretty sure it's using the same principles I had in mind for my unrealized phaser build. But that leaves the question of how it's possible to impart enough energy to impact enough people without being obvious and in sight of them. The answer is to use a carrier that can easily impart energy over a distance, a formed microwave beam, even better, a maser, which is the microwave rendition of a laser, or a high-power infrared laser, any one of these kinds of devices, but using two of them at a time. set them very precisely to be at almost identical frequencies, separated only by the relatively low frequency you want to induce on your targets. Aim them both at the same part of a wall. The energy impact will primarily produce heating, but that will manifest as mechanical vibration, which will carry into the interior of the building, and that's how the people are subjected to it. When those two close frequencies mix, the heterodyne effect, there's that word again, the heterodyne effect makes their difference, one result of the mixing. Another technical term that may apply, twin beam intermodulation. Sorry for this being a long words day. Couldn't they do this with a single beam by modulating it? Well, theoretically, sure, but that's challenging to do at high power levels. By the way, memo to the State Department. You may find certain purpose-designed earplugs to be an effective countermeasure to these electronic intrusions. And a memo to the CIA. These are large energy signature devices. If you monitor for audio between 10 Hz and 70 kHz, that's one way to identify when there's an attack. And at that point, microwave or infrared laser detection gear should help identify its source very specifically. Okay, we had the heterodyne effect on hand since 1918. It was actually discovered in 1901. But now we should also fold in that famous discovery of 1842, the Doppler effect. Know why? They both have to do with a brand new twist on LIDAR that can directly measure speed, not just distance. I'd better explain. Almost all of today's LIDAR implementations are measuring distance by measuring the time of flight of light, meaning sending a pulse, detecting the reflection of that pulse, and figuring out how much time elapsed between those two events. You can derive speed from that by taking successive measurements and determining how much the distance changes with time. But that means the first possible speed measurement requires at least two pulse readings. Now, one company, Blackmore Sensors and Analytics, Inc. of Bozeman, Montana, is taking a different approach, based both on the heterodyne effect and on the Doppler effect. Doppler tells us that when there is motion between an event originator and an event perceiver, the wavefronts or incident fronts of the event will be time compressed when approaching and time expanded when receiving, like the familiar sound you hear from a passing train or passing truck. Blackmore isn't using pulsed LIDAR. They use a continuous wave, always on laser, that gets split within their electronics head to provide both the outgoing beam and an in-circuit reference signal that you might think of as a local oscillator. The heterodyning happens when the reflected laser illumination and this reference signal both enter an optical mixer. That produces a signal that directly indicates longitudinal speed. Overall, the actual circuitry is much more nuanced and much more sophisticated than that simple explanation. It's able to provide a highly sensitive, high-resolution indication of longitudinal, latitudinal, or elevational azimuthal speeds, meaning a pretty good track on X, Y, Z axis motion in 3-space, all with no mechanical scanning. This is intended for autonomous vehicles, including cars and drones and more. For the automakers, it's an improvement on a technology they already know, continuous wave FM, that's frequency modulated radars. With light, of course, and its much smaller wavelengths, there's more available precision. Transitioning from those radar frequencies into the optical spectra presents many challenges that the Blackmore FM LIDAR Doppler development team seems to have successfully solved. And, of course, this could be adapted into constantly scanning the area around a cybernetic house to create a 3D map of everything that's moving, then using algorithms to filter out things like leaves on trees that don't carry any consequences for the structure or its occupants. So those are the connections. From early radio to thinking about making a Star Trek phaser using infrasonic and ultrasonic beams, to that kind of approach manifesting as attacks on our embassies, to a new breed of LIDAR that can kick autonomous driving or flying up a few notches. That's it for me. Let me send this back up to Hank.
Thank you, Marty. Now, where the heck did I put that Dick Tracy Super Heterodyne two-way wrist radio that I got back in 1946? I got it for $1.95. I find today a used one goes for $70.
Wow, Back to the Future. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have its general meeting Thursday, October 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and I've been asked to give a presentation, and I'm going to be talking about Back to the Future with graphical and command line utilities under the hood of Windows. Meeting will be held at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, room 411, and a photo ID is required, in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting Friday, October the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Schur Hall at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus in Old Westbury, New York. Princeton PC Users Group has their general meeting Tuesday, October the 23rd. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they hold their meeting in the community room of the Princeton Public Library at 65 Witherspoon Street in Princeton, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer User Group will have their meeting on Thursday, October the 25th at 6:45 p.m., and they meet at the Middletown Library Computer Lab at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Westchester PC User Group will be meeting Thursday, November 1st, 2018, and the meeting time is 7 p.m. They will meet at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor, White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their meeting on Friday, November the 2nd at 8 p.m. in Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society has their meeting Tuesday, November the 6th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. They meet at 24 Hospital Avenue in Danbury, Connecticut. The Ewing Computer Learning Center has their meeting on the first Tuesday of the month, beginning at 1:30 p.m. They meet in the meeting room at the Ewing Community Center, located at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. All these meetings are free and open to the public. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. I hope we'll be seeing you at one of these club meetings. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio, or BAI.org streaming on the internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.